Hello and thank you for tuning into Barkada Circle, your tribe of storytellers for nonprofit organizations. We're broadcasting on Party 93.4. Barkada is a word in the Filipino language that means best friends. Barkada Circle is a community of artists who are passionate about helping nonprofit organizations tell their stories in more compelling ways to engage people into becoming active supporters, volunteers, and donors who want to create real positive impact in their community. I'm Parangara, your main mixologist for Barkada Circle. You can check out my blog on barkadacircle.com, where I talk about storytelling for nonprofits, fundraising, and how to grow your organization's impact and value for the community. Our theme for this month is on giving the gift of story. When you tell someone your story, you give something meaningful of yourself. Sharing your experiences and your emotions gives value to your life at that very moment, and the listener has something valuable to learn from it. Storytelling gives a whole new meaning to the word present, because in order for that person to receive your gift of story, they have to be fully present in the moment. No one knows the value of giving story more than Dave Isay. As a MacArthur Fellow, Isay opened the first StoryCorps booth in New York's Grand Central Terminal in 2003 with the intention of creating a quiet place where a person could honor someone who mattered to them by listening to their story. From the first interview he recorded, he knew that he had found his calling, preserving the stories of everyday Americans, and since then, Isay has amassed hundreds of thousands of recordings, most of previously unheard or ignored voices, all speaking in their own words. StoryCorps invites friends, loved ones, and strangers to conduct 40-minute interviews at intimate recording booths as well as in mobile studios nationwide. The archives of StoryCorps are included at the American Folklife Center of the Library of Congress and now constitute the largest single collection of recorded voices in history. Let's listen to Dave Isay.
Tonight, I'm going to try to make the case that inviting a loved one, a friend, or even a stranger to record a meaningful interview with you just might turn out to be one of the most important moments in that person's life and in yours. When I was 22 years old, I was lucky enough to find my calling when I fell into making radio stories. At almost the exact same time, I found out that my dad, who I was very, very close to, was gay. I was taken completely by surprise. We were a very tight-knit family, and I was crushed. At some point in one of our strained conversations, my dad mentioned the Stonewall riots. He told me that one night in 1969, a group of young Black and Latino drag queens fought back against the police at a gay bar in Manhattan called the Stonewall Inn, and how this sparked the modern gay rights movement. It was an amazing story, and it piqued my interest. So I decided to pick up my tape recorder and find out more. With the help of a young archivist named Michael Shirker, we tracked down all of the people we could find who had been at the Stonewall Inn that night. Recording these interviews, I saw how the microphone gave me the license to go places I otherwise never would have gone and talk to people I might not otherwise ever have spoken to. I had the privilege of getting to know some of the most amazing, fierce, and courageous human beings I had ever met. It was the first time the story of Stonewall had been told to a national audience. I dedicated the program to my dad. It changed my relationship with him, and it changed my life. Over the next 15 years, I made many more radio documentaries, working to shine a light on people who are rarely heard from in the media. Over and over again, I'd see how the simple act of being interviewed could mean so much to people, particularly those who'd been told that their stories didn't matter. I could literally see people's backs straighten as they started to speak into the microphone. In 1998, I made a documentary about the last flophouse hotels on the Bowery in Manhattan. Guys stayed up in these cheap hotels for decades. They lived in cubicles the size of prison cells covered with chicken wire so you couldn't jump from one room into the next. Later, I wrote a book on the men with the photographer Harvey Wang. I remember walking into a flop house with an early version of the book and showing one of the guys his page. He stood there staring at it in silence. Then he grabbed the book out of my hand and started running down the long, narrow hallway, holding it over his head, shouting, "I exist! I exist!" In many ways, "I exist" became the clarion call for StoryCorps, this crazy idea that I had a dozen years ago. The thought was to take documentary work and turn it on its head. Traditionally, broadcast documentary has been about recording interviews to create a work of art or entertainment or education that's seen or heard by a whole lot of people. But I wanted to try something where the interview itself was the purpose of this work and see if we could give many, many, many people the chance to be listened to in this way. So in Grand Central Terminal, 11 years ago, we built a booth where anyone can come to honor someone else by interviewing them about their life. You come to this booth and you're met by a facilitator who brings you inside. You sit across from, say, your grandfather for close to an hour and you listen and you talk. Many people think of it as, if this was to be our last conversation, what would I want to ask of and say to this person who means so much to me? At the end of the session, you walk away with a copy of the interview, and another copy goes to the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress so that your great-great-great-grandkids can someday get to know your grandfather through his voice and story. So we open this booth in one of the busiest places in the world and invite people to have this incredibly intimate conversation with another human being. I had no idea if it would work. But from the very beginning, it did. People treated the experience with incredible respect, and amazing conversations happened inside. I want to play just one animated excerpt from an interview recorded at that original Grand Central booth. This is 12-year-old Joshua Littman interviewing his mother, Sarah. Josh has Asperger's syndrome. As you may know, kids with Asperger's are incredibly smart, but have a tough time socially. They usually have obsessions. In Josh's case, it's with animals. So this is Josh talking with his mom, Sarah, at Grand Central 9 years ago.
From a scale of 1 to 10, do you think your life would be different without animals?
I think it would be an 8 without animals, because they add so much pleasure to life.
How else do you think your life would be different without them?
I could do without things like cockroaches and snakes.
Well, I'm okay with snakes as long as they're not venomous or like can constrict you or anything.
Yeah, I'm not a big snake person.
But cockroach is just the insect we love to hate.
Yeah, it really is.
Have you ever thought you couldn't cope with having a child?
I remember when you were a baby, you had really bad colic, so you would just cry and cry. And
what's
I didn't
colic?
Know what... It's when you get this stomach ache and all you do is scream for like 4 hours.
Even louder than Amy does?
You were pretty loud, but Amy's was more high-pitched.
I think it feels like everyone seems to like Amy more, like she's like the perfect little angel.
Well, I can understand why you think that people like Amy more, and I'm not saying it's because of your Asperger's syndrome, but being friendly comes easily to Amy. Whereas I think for you, it's more difficult. But the people who take the time to get to know you love you so much.
Like Ben or Eric or Carlos.
Yeah, and...
Like I have better quality friends, but less quantity.
I wouldn't judge the quality, but I think...
I mean, like, first thing is, like, Amy loved Claudia, then she hated Claudia, she loved Claudia,
Claudia. Part of that's a girl thing, honey. The important thing for you is that you have a few very good friends. And really, that's what you need in life.
Did I turn out to be the son you wanted when I was born? Like, did I meet your expectations? And
you've exceeded my expectations, sweetie. Because, you know, sure, you have these fantasies of what your child's going to be like, but you have made me grow so much as a parent. Because you think...
Well, I was the one who made you a parent.
You were the one who made me a parent. That's a good point. But also, because you think differently from, you know, what they tell you in the parenting books...
Yeah.
I really had to learn to think out of the box with you, and it's made me much more creative as a parent and as a person, and I'll always thank you for that.
And that helped when Amy was born.
And that helped when Amy was born, but you were just so incredibly special to me, and I'm so lucky to have you as my son.
After this story ran on public radio, Josh received hundreds of letters telling him what an amazing kid he was. His mom, Sarah, bound them together in a book, and when Josh got picked on at school, they would read the letters together. I just want to acknowledge that two of my heroes are here with us tonight, Sarah Littman and her son, Josh, who is now an honor student in college. You know, a lot of people talk about crying when they hear StoryCorps stories. And it's not because they're sad. Most of them aren't. I think it's because you're hearing something authentic and pure at this moment when sometimes it's hard to tell what's real and what's an advertisement. It's kind of the anti-reality TV. Nobody comes to StoryCorps to get rich. Nobody comes to get famous. Simply an act of generosity and love. So many of these are just everyday people talking about lives lived with kindness, courage, decency, and dignity. And when you hear that kind of story, it can sometimes feel like you're walking on holy ground. So this experiment in Grand Central worked, and we expanded across the country. Today, more than 100,000 people in all 50 states and thousands of cities and towns across America have recorded StoryCorps interviews. It's now the largest single collection of human voices ever gathered. We've hired and trained hundreds of facilitators to help guide people through the experience. Most serve a year or two with StoryCorps, traveling the country, gathering the wisdom of humanity. They call it bearing witness. And if you ask them, all of the facilitators will tell you that the most important thing they've learned from being present during these interviews is that people are basically good. And I think for the first years of StoryCorps, you could argue that there was some kind of a selection bias happening. But after tens of thousands of interviews with every kind of person in every part of the country, rich, poor, 5 years old to 105, 80 different languages across the political spectrum, you have to think that maybe these guys are actually onto something. I've also learned so much from these interviews. I've learned about the poetry and the wisdom and the grace that can be found in the words of people all around us when we simply take the time to listen. Like this interview between a betting clerk in Brooklyn named Danny Peraza, who brought his wife Annie to StoryCorps to talk about his love for her.
You see, the thing of it is, I always feel guilty when I say I love you to you, and I say it so often. I say it to remind you that as dumpy as I am, it's coming from me. It's like hearing a beautiful song from a busted old radio. Yeah, well, and it's nice of you to keep the radio around the house.
If I don't have a note on the kitchen table, I think there's something wrong. You write a love letter to me
every
morning.
Well, the only thing that could possibly be wrong is I couldn't find a silly pen.
To my princess, the weather out today is extremely rainy. I'll call you at 11:20 in the morning.
It's a romantic weather
and
report.
And I love you, I love you, I love you.
When a guy is happily married, no matter what happens at work, no matter what happens in the rest of the day, there's a shelter when you get home. There's a knowledge, knowing that you can hug somebody without them throwing you downstairs and saying, get your hands off me. And being married is like having a color television set. You never want to go back to black and white.
Danny was about 5 feet tall with crossed eyes and one single snaggle tooth. But Danny Peraza had more romance in his little pinky than all of Hollywood's leading men put together. What else have I learned? I've learned about the almost unimaginable capacity for the human spirit to forgive. I've learned about resilience, and I've learned about strength. Like an interview with O'Shea Israel and Mary Johnson. When O'Shea was a teenager, he murdered Mary's only son, Lorenium Bird, in a gang fight. A dozen years later, Mary went to prison to meet O'Shea and find out who this person was who had taken her son's life. Slowly and remarkably, they became friends. And when he was finally released from the penitentiary, O'Shea actually moved in next door to Mary. This is just a short excerpt of a conversation they had soon after O'Shea was freed.
My natural son is no longer here. I didn't see him graduate. You know, you're going to college. I'll have the opportunity to see you graduate. I didn't see him get married. Hopefully one day I'll be able to experience that with you.
Just to hear you say those things and to be in my life in the manner that which you are is my motivation. It motivates me to make sure that I stay on the right path, you still believe in me. And the fact that you can do it despite how much pain I cause you, it's amazing.
I know it's not an easy thing, you know, to be able to share our story together, even with us sitting here looking at each other right now. I know it's not an easy thing. So I admire that you can do this.
I love you, lady.
I love you too, son.
And I've been reminded countless times of the courage and goodness of people and how the arc of history truly does bend towards justice. Like the story of Alexis Martinez, who was born Arthur Martinez in the Harold Ickes Projects in Chicago. In the interview, she talks with her daughter Leslie about joining a gang as a young man, and later in life, transitioning into the woman she was always meant to be. This is Alexis and her daughter Leslie.
One of the most difficult things for me was I was always afraid that I wouldn't be allowed to be in my granddaughter's lives. And you blew that completely out of the water, you and your husband. One of the fruits of that is, you know, my relationship with my granddaughters, they fight with each other sometimes over whether I'm he or she, you know.
But they're free to talk about it.
They're free to talk about it, but that to me is a miracle.
You don't have to apologize. You don't have to tiptoe. You know, we're not going to cut you off. And that is something I've always wanted you to, you know, just know that you're loved.
You know, I live this every day now. I walk down the streets as a woman, and I really am at peace with who I am. I mean, I wish I had a softer voice, maybe, you know. But now I walk in love, and I try to live that way every day.
Now I walk in love. I'm going to tell you a secret about StoryCorps. It takes some courage to have these conversations. StoryCorps speaks to our mortality. Participants know this recording will be heard long after they're gone. There's a hospice doctor named Ira Byock who's worked closely with us on recording interviews with people who are dying. He wrote a book called The Four Things That Matter Most, about the four things you want to say to the most important people in your life before they or you die. Thank you. I love you. Forgive me. I forgive you. They're just about the most powerful words we can say to one another. And often that's what happens in a StoryCorps booth. It's a chance to have a sense of closure with someone you care about, no regrets, nothing left unsaid, and it's hard and it takes courage. But that's why we're alive, right? So, the TED Prize. When I first heard from Ted and Chris a few months ago about the possibility of the prize, I was completely floored. They asked me to come up with a very brief wish for humanity, no more than 50 words. So I thought about it, I wrote my 50 words, and a few weeks later, Chris called and said, go for it. So here is my wish, that you will help us take everything we've learned through StoryCorps and bring it to the world, so that anyone, anywhere, can easily record a meaningful interview with another human being, which will then be archived for history. How are we going to do that? With this. We're fast moving into a future where everyone in the world will have access to one of these, and it has powers I never could have imagined 11 years ago when I started StoryCorps. It has a microphone, it can tell you how to do things, and it can send audio files. Those are the key ingredients. So the first part of the wish is already underway. Over the past couple of months, the team at StoryCorps has been working furiously to create an app that will bring StoryCorps out of our booths so that it can be experienced by anyone, anywhere, anytime. Remember, StoryCorps has always been two people and a facilitator helping them record their conversation, which is preserved forever. But at this very moment, we're releasing a public beta version of the StoryCorps app. The app is a digital facilitator that walks you through the StoryCorps interview process, helps you pick questions, and gives you all the tips you need to record a meaningful StoryCorps interview. And then with one tap, upload it to our archive at the Library of Congress. That's the easy part, the technology. The real challenge is up to you, to take this tool and figure out how we can use it all across America and around the world, so that instead of recording thousands of StoryCorps interviews a year, we could potentially record tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands or maybe even more. Imagine, for example, a national homework assignment where every high school student studying U.S. history across the country records an interview with an elder over Thanksgiving so that in one single weekend, an entire generation of American lives and experiences are captured. Or imagine mothers on opposite sides of a conflict somewhere in the world sitting down not to talk about that conflict, but to find out who they are as people, and in doing so, begin to build bonds of trust. Or that someday it becomes a tradition all over the world that people are honored with a StoryCorps interview on their 75th birthday. Or that people in your community go into retirement homes or hospitals or homeless shelters or even prisons armed with this app to honor the people least hurt in our society and ask them who they are, what they've learned in life, and how they want to be remembered. Ten years ago, I recorded a StoryCorps interview with my dad, who was a psychiatrist and became a well-known gay activist. This is the picture of us at that interview. I never thought about that recording until a couple of years ago when my dad, who seemed to be in perfect health and was still seeing patients 40 hours a week, was diagnosed with cancer. He passed away very suddenly a few days later. It was June 28, 2012, the anniversary of the Stonewall riots. I listened to that interview for the first time at 3 a.m. on the day that he died. I have a couple of young kids at home, and I knew that the only way they were going to get to know this person who was such a towering figure in my life would be through that session. I thought I couldn't believe in StoryCorps any more deeply than I did, but it was at that moment that I fully and viscerally grasped the importance of making these recordings. Every day, people come up to me and say, I wish I had interviewed my father or my grandmother or my brother, but I waited too long. Now, no one has to wait anymore. At this moment, when so much of how we communicate is fleeting and inconsequential, join us in creating this digital archive of conversations that are enduring and important. Help us create this gift to our children, this testament to who we are as human beings. I hope you'll help us make this wish come true. Interview a family member, a friend, or even a stranger. Together we can create an archive of the wisdom of humanity. And maybe in doing so, we'll learn to listen a little more and shout a little less. Maybe these conversations will remind us what's really important. And maybe, just maybe, it will help us recognize that simple truth that every life, every single life, matters equally and infinitely. Thank you very much.
StoryCorps is an act of generosity and love. That was Dave Isay, recorded at TED in March of 2015. This is Parangara, and you're listening to Barkata Circle on Party 93.4.
Say your lover had to fly, he gave you no reason why. But I would never do that to you. best thing about being true. Lay down your sleepy head, you told me you wish you were dead. That's okay, dear, that's alright. I will stay with you through the night. Yes, I will do that for you. Cause I have this thing about being true. Texas highway. Now I don't mean to sound unkind, but today you didn't even cross my mind.
And that was Barley Station with their song True. We are Barcata Circle on Party 93.4. You can follow us on twitter.com/party93.4 and facebook.com/party93.4. Storytellers have the intrinsic ability to take us to different worlds and to see things through the lens of different characters. This is their gift, so that we may gain fresh perspectives on the issues that matter most to us. When ABC kicked off its 2014 television season by devoting its Thursday night lineup to the shows How to Get Away with Murder, Scandal, and Grey's Anatomy, Shonda Rhimes, already one of the most influential producers in Hollywood, became arguably the single most powerful voice in television today. Rhimes is known for her groundbreaking storytelling, her candor, and humor in the face of her critics, and for never shying away from speaking her mind. Her first book, entitled Year of Yes, was published in November of 2015. As a media titan responsible for 70 hours of television per season, she loves to work. When I am hard at work, when I am deep in it, there is no other feeling, she says. She has a name for this feeling, the hum. The hum is a drug. The hum is music. The hum is God's whisper in her ear. But what happens when it stops? Is she anything besides the hum? In this moving talk, Rhimes takes us on a journey through her year of yes, and how she got her hum back. Let's listen to Shonda Rhimes.
TED Talks are recorded live at the TED Conference and partner events. This episode features writer and producer Shonda Rhimes. Here's Shonda Rhimes.
So, a while ago, I tried an experiment. For 1 year, I would say yes to all the things that scared me. Anything that made me nervous, took me out of my comfort zone, I forced myself to say yes to. Did I want to speak in public? No, but yes. Did I want to be on live TV? No, but yes. Did I want to try acting? No, 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 but yes, yes, yes. And a crazy thing happened. The very act of doing the thing that scared me undid the fear, made it not scary. My fear of public speaking, my social anxiety, poof, gone. It's amazing the power of one word. Yes changed my life. Yes changed me. But there was one particular yes that affected my life in the most profound way, in a way I never imagined. And it started with a question from my toddler. I have these three amazing daughters, Harper, Beckett, and Emerson. And Emerson's a toddler who inexplicably refers to everyone as honey, as though she's a Southern waitress. Honey, I'm gonna need some milk from my sippy cup. The Southern waitress asked me to play with her one evening when I was on my way somewhere, and I said yes. And that yes was the beginning of a new way of life for my family. I made a vow that from now on, every time one of my children asks me to play, no matter what I'm doing or where I'm going, I say yes, every single time. Almost. I'm not perfect at it, but I try hard to practice it. And it's had a magical effect on me, on my children, on our family. But it's also had a stunning side effect. And it wasn't until recently that I fully understood it, that I understood that saying yes to playing with my children likely saved my career. See, I have what most people would call a dream job. I'm a writer, I imagine, I make stuff up for a living. Dream job. No, I'm a titan. Dream job. I create television, I executive produce television, I make television, a great deal of television. In one way or another, this TV season, I'm responsible for bringing about 70 hours of programming to the world. 4 television programs, 70 hours of TV, 3 shows in production at a time, sometimes 4. Each show creates hundreds of jobs that didn't exist before. The budget for one episode of network television can be anywhere from $3 to $6 million, so let's just say 5. A new episode made every 9 days times 4 shows, so every 9 days, that's $20 million worth of television, 4 television programs, 70 hours of TV, 3 shows in production at a time, sometimes 4, 16 episodes going on at all times. 24 episodes of Grey's, 21 episodes of Scandal, 15 episodes of How to Get Away with Murder, 10 episodes of The Catch, that's 70 hours of TV, that's $350 million for a season. In America, my television shows air back to back to back on Thursday night. Around the world, my shows air 256 territories in 67 languages for an audience of 30 million people. My brain is global. And 45 hours of that 70 hours of TV are shows I personally created and not just produced. So on top of everything else, I need to find time, real, quiet, creative time, to gather my fans around the campfire and tell my stories. 4 television programs, 70 hours of TV, 3 shows in production at a time, sometimes 4, $350 million, campfires burning all over the world. You know who else is doing that? Nobody. So, like I said, I'm a titan. Dream job. Now, I don't tell you this to impress you. I tell you this because I know what you think of when you hear the word writer. I tell you this so that all of you out there who work so hard, whether you run a company or a country or a classroom or a store or a home, take me seriously when I talk about working, so you'll get that I don't peck at a computer and imagine all day. So you'll hear me when I say that I understand that a dream job is not about dreaming. It's all job, all work, all reality, all blood, all sweat, no tears. I work a lot, very hard, and I love it. When I am hard at work, when I am deep in it, there is no other feeling. For me, my work is at all times building a nation out of thin air. It is manning the troops. It is painting a canvas. It is hitting every high note. It is running a marathon. It is being Beyoncé. And it is all of those things at the same time. I love working. It is creative and mechanical and exhausting and exhilarating and hilarious and disturbing and clinical and maternal and cruel and judicious. And what makes it all so good is the hum. There is some kind of shift inside me when the work gets good. A hum begins in my brain, and it grows, and that hum sounds like the open road, and I could drive it forever. And a lot of people, when I try to explain the hum, they assume that I'm talking about the writing, that my writing brings me joy, and don't get me wrong, it does. But the hum, it wasn't until I started making television that I started working and making and building and creating and collaborating that I discovered this thing, this buzz, this rush, this hum. The hum is more than writing. The hum is action and activity. The hum is a drug. The hum is music. The hum is light and air. The hum is God's whisper right in my ear. And when you have a hum like that, you can't help but strive for greatness. That feeling, you can't help but strive for greatness at any cost. That's called the hum. Or maybe it's called being a workaholic. Maybe it's called genius. Maybe it's called ego. Maybe it's just fear of failure. I don't know. I just know that I'm not built for failure, and I just know that I love the hum. I just know that I want to tell you I'm a Titan, and I know that I don't want to question it. But here's the thing. The more successful I become, the more shows, the more episodes, the more barriers broken, the more work there is to do. The more balls in the air, the more eyes on me, the more history stares, the more expectations there are. The more I work to be successful, the more I need to work. And what did I say about work? I love working, right? The nation I'm building, the marathon I'm running, the troops, the canvas, the high note, the hum, the hum, the hum. I like that hum. I love that hum. I need that hum. I am that hum. Am I nothing but that hum? And then the hum stopped. Overworked, overused, overdone, burned out, the hum stopped. Now, my three daughters are used to the truth that their mother is a single working Titan. Harper tells people, my mom won't be there, but you can text my nanny. And Emerson says, honey, I'm wanting to go to Shondaland. They're children of a Titan. They're baby Titans. They were 12, 3, and 1 when the hum stopped. The hum of the engine died. I stopped loving work. I couldn't restart the engine. The hum would not come back. My hum was broken. I was doing the same things I always did, all the same Titan work. 15-hour days, working straight through the weekends, no regrets, never surrender. A Titan never sleeps. A Titan never quits. Full hearts, clear eyes, yada, whatever. But there was no hum. Inside me was silence. 4 television programs, 70 hours of TV, 3 shows in production at a time, sometimes 4. 4 television programs, 70 hours of TV, 3 shows in production at a time, sometimes 4. I was the perfect Titan. I was a Titan you could take home to your mother. All the colors were the same, and I was no longer having any fun. And it was my life. It was all I did. I was the hum, and the hum was me. So what do you do when the thing you do, the work you love, starts to taste like dust? Now, I know somebody's out there thinking, cry me a river, stupid writer Titan lady. But you know, you do. If you make, if you work, if you love what you do, being a teacher, being a banker, being a mother, being a painter, being Bill Gates, if you simply love another person, if that gives you the hum, if you know the hum, if you know what the hum feels like, if you have been to the hum, when the hum stops, who are you? What are you? What am I? Am I still a Titan? If the song of my heart ceases to play, can I survive in the silence? And then my Southern waitress toddler asks me a question. I'm on my way out the door. I'm late. And she says, Mama, want to play? And I'm just about to say no when I realize 2 things. 1, I'm supposed to say yes to everything. And 2, my Southern waitress didn't call me honey. She's not calling everyone honey anymore. When did that happen? I'm missing it, being a Titan and mourning my hum, and here she is changing right before my eyes. And so she says, Mama, want to play? And I say yes. There's nothing special about it. We play, and we're joined by her sisters, and there's a lot of laughing, and I give a dramatic reading from the book, Everybody Poops. Nothing out of the ordinary. And yet, it is extraordinary, because in my pain and my panic, in the homelessness of my humlessness, I have nothing to do but pay attention. I focus. I am still. The nation I'm building, the marathon I'm running, the troops, the canvas, the high note, does not exist. all that exists are sticky fingers and gooey kisses and tiny voices and crayons and that song about letting go of whatever it is that Frozen Girl needs to let go of. It's all peace and simplicity. The air is so rare in this place for me that I can barely breathe. I can barely believe I'm breathing. Play is the opposite of work. And I am happy. Something in me loosens, a door in my brain swings open, and a rush of energy comes. And it's not instantaneous, but it happens. It does happen. I feel it. A hum creeps back. Not at full volume, barely there. It's quiet, and I have to stay very still to hear it, but it is there. Not the hum, but a hum. And now I feel like I know a very magical secret. Well, let's not get carried away. It's just love. That's all it is. No magic, no secret. It's just love. It's just something we forgot. The hum, the work hum, the hum of the Titan, that's just a replacement. If I have to ask you who I am, if I have to tell you who I am, if I describe myself in terms of shows and hours of television and how globally badass my brain is, I have forgotten what the real hum is. The hum is not power, and the hum is not work specific. The hum is joy specific. The real hum is love specific. The hum is the electricity that comes from being excited by life. The real hum is confidence and peace. The real hum ignores the stare of history and the balls in the air and the expectation and the pressure. The real hum is singular and original. The real hum is God's whisper in my ear, but maybe God was whispering the wrong words because which one of the gods was telling me I was a Titan? It's just love. We could all use a little more love, a lot more love. Anytime my child asks me to play, I will say yes. I make it a firm rule for one reason, to give myself permission to free me from all of my workaholic guilt. It's a law, so I don't have a choice. And I don't have a choice, not if I want to feel the hum. I wish it were that easy, but I'm not good at playing. I don't like it. I'm not interested in doing it the way I am interested in doing work. The truth is incredibly humbling and humiliating to face. I don't like playing. I work all the time because I like working. I like working more than I like being at home. Facing that fact is incredibly difficult to handle. Because what kind of person likes working more than being at home? Well, me. I mean, let's be honest, I call myself a Titan. I've got issues. And one of those issues isn't that I am too relaxed. We run around the yard, up and back and up and back. We have 30-second dance parties. We sing show tunes. We play with balls. I blow bubbles and they pop them. And I feel stiff and delirious and confused most of the time. I itch for my cell phone always, but it is okay. My tiny humans show me how to live, and the hum of the universe fills me up. I play and I play until I begin to wonder why we ever stopped playing in the first place. You can do it too. Say yes every time your child asks you to play. Are you thinking maybe that I'm an idiot in diamond shoes? You're right, but you can still do this. You have time. You know why? Because you're not Rihanna and you're not a Muppet. Your child does not think you're that interesting. You only need 15 minutes. My 2 and 4-year-old only ever want to play with me for about 15 minutes or so before they think to themselves they want to do something else. It's an amazing 15 minutes, but it's 15 minutes. If I'm not a ladybug or a piece of candy, I'm invisible after 15 minutes. And my 13-year-old, if I can get a 13-year-old to talk to me for 15 minutes, I'm parent of the year. 15 minutes is all you need. I can totally pull off 15 minutes of uninterrupted time on my worst day. Uninterrupted is the key. No cell phone, no laundry, no anything. You have a busy life. You have to get dinner on the table. You have to force them to bathe, but you can do 15 minutes. My kids are my happy place. They're my world. But it doesn't have to be your kids. The fuel that feeds your hum, the place where life feels more good than not good. It's not about playing with your kids. It's about joy. It's about playing in general. Give yourself the 15 minutes. Find what makes you feel good. Just figure it out and play in that arena. I'm not perfect at it. In fact, I fail as often as I succeed. Seeing friends, reading books, staring into space. Wanna play starts to become shorthand for indulging myself in ways I'd given up on right around the time I got my first TV show, right around the time I became a titan in training, right around the time I started competing with myself for ways unknown. 15 minutes, what could be wrong with giving myself my full attention for 15 minutes? Turns out, nothing. The very act of not working has made it possible for the hum to return, as if the hum's engine could only refuel while I was away. Work doesn't work without play. It takes a little time, but after a few months, one day the floodgates open and there's a rush and I find myself standing in my office filled with an unfamiliar melody, full-on groove inside me and around me, and it sends me spinning with ideas and the humming road is open and I can drive it and drive it and I love working again. But now, I like that hum, but I don't love that hum. I don't need that hum. I am not that hum. That hum is not me, not anymore. I am bubbles and sticky fingers and dinners with friends. I am that hum, life's hum, love's hum. Work's hum is still a piece of me. It is just no longer all of me. And I am so grateful. And I don't give a crap about being a titan because I've never once seen a titan play Red Rover, Red Rover. I said yes to less work and more play, and somehow I still run my world. My brain is still global. My campfires still burn. The more I play, the happier I am, and the happier my kids are. The more I play, the more I feel like a good mother. The more I play, the freer my mind becomes. The more I play, the better I work. The more I play, the more I feel the hum, the nation I'm building, the marathon I'm running, the troops, the canvas, the high note, the hum, the other hum, the real hum. Life's hum. The more I feel that hum, the more this strange, quivering, uncocooned, awkward, brand new, alive, non-titan feels like me. The more I feel that hum, the more I know who I am. I'm a writer. I make stuff up. I imagine. That part of the job, that's living the dream. That's the dream of the job. Because a dream job should be a little bit dreamy. I said yes to less work and more play. Titans need not apply. Want to play? Thank you.
That was Shonda Rhimes, recorded at TED in February 2016. This is Panangara, and you're listening to Barkata Circle on Party 93.4. And that brings us to the end of today's program. Stay tuned for Uber Jazz at 3 p.m. Eastern and more non-traditional independent programming. Party 93.4 is a project of the Freeform Radio Initiative, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide diverse and innovative online broadcasting that reflects the interests and concerns of the community. If you like the program that you've been listening to, please consider supporting the Freeform Radio Initiative by making a tax-deductible donation. You can go to the website at freeformradio.org or party934.com and click on the donate button. Thanks in advance for your support. I would also like to invite you to sign up for the e-newsletter. It's a simple way to show your support and a great way to keep tabs on the Freeform Radio Initiative. You can sign up by going to party934.com and filling the entry field on the homepage with your email address. It's that simple. This is Panangara, your mixologist for Barkata Circle and storytelling for nonprofits. Thank you once again for listening. Till next time, discover how telling your story will spark another story from someone across the table or perhaps across the globe, so you can make meaningful connections, foster understanding, and bring about real change in people's lives. Have a great week.